So, good evening, everybody, and great to see everyone for this bittersweet lesson four. It's sweet because I've been having a super sweet experience throughout this course, but it is the final lesson tonight, so it's also bitter. But bittersweet, nonetheless. So, I hope everyone had a good weekend. So it was Yom Kippur in the morning, and this one rabbi decided, you know what, I've had it. I'm not going to synagogue today. I'm going golfing. So he goes, the angels turn to God, and they say, I don't know if you noticed, but this rabbi just is heading to the golf course. So God says, don't worry, I'll take care of it. The rabbi goes, and hole in one, he's having the best game of his life. And the angels go back to God and they say, you said you're on top of this. What's going on? He's having the best game of his life. And God says, who is he going to tell? Tonight, of course, we're going to be focusing on angels or paranormal angels, demons, ghosts, and similar. Last week we talked about the power of curses and the evil eye. We talked about things that we can do to be able to ward off the evil eye, like making sure we have a kosher mezuzah, like other things that in Jewish tradition they've focused on. And we also talked about seeing to it that our lives should be perhaps a little bit more modest than they were until now. And we talked about the fact, what the Talmud says, that divine blessing dwells the most on something that's hidden from the eye. So if we want to avoid all these things, then it's much better to go that much more hidden from the eye than perhaps we were until now. But tonight, we're going to turn our attention, as noted, to a different topic. And, of course, it's the final lesson of this course, Jupiter Natural. So, let's start with hearing what you guys have to say. By the raise of hand, how many of you believe in angels? Okay, almost everybody. Don't worry. We can. I know it's a Jewish crowd, but we can raise hands. Don't worry. Let's suspend the modesty for the questions, okay? How many of you believe in demons? Okay, a lot less. How about in ghosts? Even less. Okay, extraterrestrials? Okay. You may be surprised to learn that among all the things, even compared to the things we discussed last week, a very large number of people in the United States believe in angels. A very significant number. So, hello Anna, welcome.
Thank you, sorry I'm late.
No problem. So, as you would imagine, being that based on the amount and number of hands that went up, Torah deals with angels extensively. There are a couple of seats, by the way, Anna. One to my right, one to my left, and one straight ahead, among others. Okay, so anyone want to volunteer in describing what do you think of when you think angel? What image comes to mind? Carlos?
Well, besides the different the way that Ezekiel kind of described them, which is very like out of the imagination, for me they've always seemed to be kind of like aspects of Hashem almost, or like kind of like programs that are just like assigned to a specific task.
What about the image?
Image.
What conjures up in your mind?
Light.
Light. Anyone else? Nothing. Okay. So, listen, I could speak for myself, right? Carlos says light, something like pure, something whitish, maybe wings. He mentioned Ezekiel, something fuzzy, something like with an image but without at the same time kind of comes into your mind. Now obviously these images, they're just made up because we need to think of something when we think of angels, not that they actually have any image. So we're going to start with how Maimonides presents in his work, in the very beginning of his 14-volume work, in the laws of the fundamentals of Torah and Judaism. And over there he presents what our belief is when it comes to angels. And let's hear how he presents it to us. to us. Carlos, being that you started, I'm going to ask Neil right next to you to read text number one. And by the way, a warm Texas welcome to Neil, who joined, he snuck it in at the fourth lesson, but joined us tonight for the first time, a first-time JLI student, right? So we always extend a warm welcome to our first-timers. No one ever stays a first-timer, just so you know. But it's great to have you. And we're text number one, page 115, if you can read for us in English, please.
God created in this world beings that are spiritual and have no material substance. These are angels, which have no body or physical figure. They are spiritual entities. What are we to make of the prophet's descriptions that they saw an angel of fire or with wings? These are all prophetic visions, and they serve as parables. We find such figurative illustrations in the verse of God is a consuming fire, Deuteronomy 4:24. God is not fire. In the description of him in this matter, is metaphoric. Similarly, the verse states, he makes his angels like winds, Psalms 104, verse 4, using wind as a metaphor. Since they possess no body, in what manner are each of the angels distinct from each other? They are distinct in the sense that no two angels have an identical spiritual composition. They are on a chain-like continuum, one higher than the other, each sustaining that which is lower than it. They all exist by God's power and benevolence.
Thank you very much. So it's clear that in Jewish belief, angels have no physical form. The fact that we apply any physical terminology to them is similar to the way we do so about God himself. The Torah itself mentions the fact, the arm of God. Does God have an arm? Of course not. But we need some type of terminology so that we can have some way to think about it in our imagination. So something like that is used, or God's anger, or God's anything else that often may be used, the eyes of God or the mouth of God. None of these mean what they sound like. It's just that they're used as metaphors so that we can have some type of concept of what we're talking about. If it says mouth, of course, it's talking about the way God expresses, but it doesn't mean that there's actually a mouth. Lou, you had a question?
Yes, so if the angels have no physical material substance, how do others see them? So Abraham saw the three angels.
Excellent, excellent. We're going to touch upon that, but being that you're asking, so in that case, these angels actually were enclosed within a body. They were in human disguise, but they were still angels. In fact, when it says that he served them food, so they actually made believe they're eating, because they don't have to eat, of course. So they made it look like they were actually eating the food, you know, just to be kind to their host. Yes?
Isn't that specific kind of angel called Ishim, I believe? And that means something like in the form of a man, which implies that it's not actually a man, just he looks like.
Yeah, good observation. That is a category of angels, and I believe Maimonides does make reference to them in that same chapter. So now that we have a picture, or really non-picture, of what they are, what do they do? Why are there angels? What's the purpose of angels? What is their role? Anybody?
The messengers from God.
Messengers, that's a great one. Messenger is the key word here. So they are messengers, but what are they doing as messengers? What are they delivering? What's their what errands, whose errands, and what exactly are they doing, and what route are they taking? So the truth is that they actually have, we can say, a dual role when we call them messengers, and maybe even two directional. Let's see what the third Chabad Rebbe wrote, who was a renowned Kabbalist, known as the Tzemach Tzedek, that's the name of his work, in text number 2. Neil, if you could please read the English for us.
Sure. The word for angel, malach, means emissary. The malachim serve as emissaries that transmit God's creative energy to sustain the world and all that they contain. Emissaries speak nothing of their own. They merely convey the message their principal has given them. Similarly, the Malachim are merely conduits to transmit the flow from its source to the recipient. There are also Malachim who serve as emissaries on behalf of the Jewish people, collecting their good deeds and spiritual inspiration and bringing them before God. Regarding the angels that receive the prayers, the Zohar teaches that they are needed because it is impossible for physical sounds and words to ascend to heaven and become subsumed in the divine source without them first being refined by the angels. The Malachim aren't independent beings. They are merely tools of the divine light that is within them.
Thank you very much, Neil. So, what are we gathering here when it comes to angels? First of all, just to be clear, angel in Hebrew is malach. Okay, that's in the singular, angels, and the plural is malachim, in case you notice the word again, or in case I use it. So, what is he telling us? That the role of the malach, of the angel, is to actually shuttle two directions. The role of the angel, number one, is when a certain flow or a certain something needs to be transmitted from the divine to our world, and for something to be transformed, if you will, from something totally spiritual to be able to manifest itself in our reality, which is physical, so it needs to undergo some change. And that's the role of the angel. Why the angel? Because the angel is kind of somewhere in between. On one hand, we said it's a spiritual entity and doesn't have any physical form. At the same time, an angel is still a creation. Because it's a creation, that's why it could relate to us and has some common ground with us as well. We are creations too. The angels are also creations. So because it has both of these components, on one hand, it's a creation. It's not the creator. It's a creation. But on the other, it's still a all spiritual entity. That's why it's able to serve as, if you will, I don't want to use the word intermediary because that's not its role. It's just a delivery boy. But the reason why it's able to accomplish this is because it has something of both entities, the divine and of our created reality. So on one hand, it takes from the divine and brings what God wants to give to us, and then it manifests into physical reality. At the same time, it also takes deliveries, so to speak, from us and brings them to God, because us and God are in two different realities, spiritual and physical. So when all we have to bring up, so to speak, is the physical. In order for it to reach God, that's the role of the angel to bring it up to the divine. Think, for example, yes, Neil.
So the language that said God spoke to Moses or spoke to, that never is actually God speaking directly?
Well, it's God speaking in the sense that God is revealing something to Moses.
Right.
But to say that God has a mouth the way we have, no.
But is he revealing it directly to Moses or through an angel?
To Moses, yes. Moses was unique among prophets, where it's stated clearly about him only that he stood face to face with God, like two friends communicate, so to speak.
Abraham, because there's multiple times where God supposedly, at least my limited knowledge.
Well, there's clearly communication. But only about Moses does it say that he was like face to face to God. Like unique among all prophets. And there's many different levels of prophecy too, and we kind of dealt with it somewhat in the last course, in the Booksmart course, when we dealt with the Bible and the prophets, etc. So there's many different levels to prophecy, clearly. And whenever in the Torah it says that God communicated to somebody, including, I mean, anyone from Adam and Eve to Noah to Abraham, etc., it's full of it on every page. There is communication happening, which means that something is being revealed. And how exactly that happened, if they heard a voice, if they heard an inspiration or an intuition, that I can't tell you precisely. But like I said about Moses, he had a very unique relationship in that sense. Yes?
So this interpretation would seem to indicate that angels have no free will because they're...
Absolutely right. They have no free will. And I was just going to get to that in a second. I'll come back to it. Was there one more quick thing before? Someone else? No? Okay. So just think of a human being. If I have warm feelings to somebody else, in my heart. So I need certain ways to express it and to share it. So if I'm feeling love towards somebody, if I want to communicate it, I need my arm to give somebody a hug, or you need to use your mouth to communicate it, to convey it. So similarly, in other words, that translates and becomes a vehicle for the spiritual feeling. A feeling is a spiritual thing. It's not a physical thing. How do I take that feeling and translate it into something that the other could receive? I need my arms, or you need your mouth, etc. So similarly, when God wants to take something spiritual and turn it into something that we could relate to in this reality, in our reality, so there's a need for something, for some transition. And that is where the role of the angel comes in. If you think of, we all know about this image, right? Where does it come from?
Jacob's dream,
which we mentioned in the lesson about dreams. So what does it say? What did he see in his dream? He actually saw angels that were ascending and descending this ladder. V'hine malachei Elokim olim v'yordim bo. What does it mean? Why were angels? It actually says that angels were going up before it says that angels were coming down. But don't angels start in heaven? Shouldn't they be coming down before they go up? But the answer is that they have this dual responsibility of going both directions on this highway, on this God-us highway. If that's the case, then yes, they also bring things up to God, so to speak, that are physical and need to be turned into something more spiritual, because here things are very coarse, and in heaven more refined, and therefore they serve in this role when it comes to both directions. But as Stuart noted, we should never get carried away with angels, because angels don't have free choice of their own. They shouldn't become the center of attention. Just like when somebody does a delivery, of course. So when someone, a human being, does a delivery, then you still thank them because yes, maybe they were hired and they don't really have a choice. They have to do it and they're committed to doing the delivery, but they still have a choice to do it or not. So we acknowledge them and we thank them. The angels don't get our attention whatsoever. Only God and God himself gets the attention. The fact that the angels are bringing it either direction, that's none of our business. In other words, they don't become something. We certainly don't worship them, nor do we even pay any attention to them, just because they're just like a mechanism through which it happens. Just think of when you, anyone here dictate their text messages like I do? Okay, so when you're speaking, And then these words that you're saying appear on the screen. So exactly what you're saying is exactly what's appearing. Meaning the software is just serving its purpose. It doesn't have a role It doesn't mix in to decide what should be said or not. Maybe on my phone it does. But but it doesn't really, it doesn't have an opinion. Exactly what you type, let's just say, that's what's going to appear on the screen. That's what angels are. They are just serving a very specific role, but they have no opinion. God created them with no free choice, and they are programmed to carry out exactly what they were designed to do. Yes?
What's the point of saying Shalom Aleichem?
We'll come to that. Excellent. Thank you. Give us a minute. Give us a minute. Okay. So that said, it just so happens to be, by the way, that this role of the angels is only relevant in our reality today. Of course, as we noted in the past, that one of the 13 principles of Jewish faith is that we believe in the coming of Mashiach, in our Redeemer, who God will send, hopefully very soon, and redeem the Jewish people from this long, bitter exile and restore the temple, which will be the third temple, the permanent temple. And when that happens, when we enter this era of world peace, etc., etc., we're not going to need the angels anymore to serve in this role. Because at that point, there's not going to be anything physical that needs to be translated into spiritual. Because reality will be a spiritual one. Our sensitivity for spirituality will be totally different than it is now. Now, our sensitivity is largely for materialism. Here and there, we have some spiritual inspiration, but our default setting is the physical. We need to be convinced that there's also a spiritual reality. When Mashiach comes, it's going to be flipped. This spirituality is going to be our default setting. We're not going to need any convincing. What we will need convincing about is the fact that there is also a physical reality. But anyway, but as long as we're in exile, we will need their services. Dale, you had a question? Somebody? Maybe somebody was stretching. Who knows? Okay. So with that, let's advance. So what else are the roles of the angels? We spoke about one, that they have to be the one that convey the divine plenty from above down to this world and convey human thoughts, feelings, and prayers and mitzvot to God Almighty. So there's another component that angels serve, another role that they serve. And that is, anyone know where we reference them in our prayers? There's more than one, but you may think of, you may identify one or another. What was that? So, I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but right now I want to draw your attention to the Amida, which is, of course, is the climax of the prayers. And in the repetition of the Amida, so towards the beginning, about a half a minute into it, we say something called Kedusha. The first word of it is Nakdishach. Ron,
yeah.
Got a book? Okay. Text number 4, please. By the way, Ron took the first 3 classes in a different branch. So good to see you here tonight. If you could read text number 4 for us in English.
Sure. We will hallow and adore you as the sweet words of the assembly of the holy angels who thrice repeat holy unto you, as it is written by your prophet. And they call one to another and say, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. Isaiah 6:3.
Thank you. So what's the Hebrew for that? For the holy, holy, holy?
Kadosh,
kadosh, kadosh. Exactly. So what are we saying? Why are we invoking the angels and the way they praise God?
Why 3 times?
And, well, why 3 times? Good question. Because the angels are, when they're saying the word holy in Hebrew, kadosh really means like separated, lofty, and removed. What they're saying is that when they praise God, what essentially they're saying is that they're acknowledging a dimension of godliness that transcends them. When they say something's holy, just like when we say something is holy, when we acknowledge something's holy, it means it's beyond us. when the angels are calling out Kadosh, Kadosh, they are acknowledging that God and God's essence is beyond their grasp, and they are like longing and aspiring to connect to a higher level of godliness than they are. They're like trying to reach up to it, so to speak. Why are we saying it as well in our prayers? Because what we're acknowledging, that if the angels acknowledge God, and the angels are more spiritual than we are, so we too want to acknowledge God. It's almost like when, if you have like, I don't know, let's say you have a mentor, and then you discover who your mentor's mentor is. That's really impressive. You also want to know who that is. You want to know who your mentor respects. Then you certainly should be respecting them, because I even respect my mentor. If he's receiving from someone else, I want to know them too. So by acknowledging the fact that the angels recognize God and aspire for a deeper connection to God than what they have, it actually inspires us and triggers us and arouses within us a deeper yearning and longing to connect to God. And this is why we mention this in the Amida, but also in our own prayers before the Shema, we say it, for the same reason, because we draw inspiration from the angels. Excellent observation. Yes, so when we recite the Amida, we put our feet together. You may be aware or not aware, we kind of just keep them together, even if during the rest of the prayer we're just standing without them necessarily together. And the reason for that is because angels are referred to as having one leg. V'raglehem regel yishara. Now what that means is, because they don't even have one leg, so why are we saying they have one if it's not physical? And the answer is, when we say that they have one leg, what it means is that they have one dimension and one MO. They only have one way of operating. They can't switch channels. A human being has the ability to surprise oneself. Maybe, who knows, for 10 years or a year or a month, we were like operating in a certain mode, maybe connecting to God in a certain way. We have the ability to change course and surprise ourselves and outdo ourselves and take a different course altogether. Not to get carried away here, but it says about Abraham, Abraham loved God. He was all about love, all about kindness. He was hospitable. What does it say after his 10th test, after he passed the tenth test of the binding of Isaac? God says to Abraham, now I know that you also fear me. Up until now, I knew that you served me out of love. But love and awe are two different emotions. So the fact that he loved God and served God out of love until now, that was confirmed over and over again. The 10th test, why did it surpass everything else? Because now he served God by going out of his comfort zone. He didn't serve God with his nature, with the way he was inclined to up until now. Certain people are naturally good at certain things, and maybe they give that away to God, or they give that away to the community, and they serve in that way. But what if, when they're called upon for something that's not their comfort zone, how do we react then? We may say, well, it's not my thing. Or, Rabbi, my plate is full. Or whatever, it just doesn't resonate with me. But what Abraham proved here is that serving God is not only with what resonates. Sometimes we also have to serve God in a way that doesn't initially resonate, because that's exactly what God is testing us, to see if you are serving yourself, meaning just with what comes to you naturally, or are you serving me? If you're serving God, then we do so even in ways with which we surprise ourselves. So the angel, I know this was a long answer to this question, but the angels are one-legged, meaning they're programmed. They only serve God in one way. They can't change. They can't try something new. A human being always has that capacity. Somebody, yes, Mike.
Are there examples of the angels where they have bilateral conversations, or somebody doesn't agree with them, and they?
I mean, there's conversations recorded in the Bible, as we'll see, between humans and angels too.
Yeah.
as we said, they can come in disguise sometimes, or they can appear in some way and they get the attention. Maybe they need to convey a certain message, and we'll see a few examples soon.
I'm going to go out on a limb here because I know we're getting ready to address it in texts 8:6-7. But again, what you know, the angels are coming at us on a very daily basis, and many, 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 depending on the person. So we may not be ready to hear angel number one, or we progress a little bit to be closer to God, and then another ministering angel comes and tells us something else, and we're now open spiritually to hear the message and to do something with it.
Yes, that is a good observation. Thank you. So, angels on earth, as somebody mentioned before, on Friday night, we have an appearance of angels. Anyone know when? Or how we acknowledge them?
Abraham with the angels with Sarah before she became pregnant.
That is a biblical story, but how do we acknowledge angels in our life on Friday evening? Anybody? Go for it. Shalom Aleichem Malachei. We'll pause right there. Text number 6 has it. So, what does it mean? We are actually welcoming angels to our home. As the Zohar tells us in text 5, that, you know what? Where are we? Dale? Please read that for us. Text number 5, straight out of the Zohar. Thank you very much. So, angels accompany us to the Shabbat meal on Friday night, and we welcome them, and then we ask them to bless us, Barchuni, and we say each one 3 times, and then we wish them well. We say Tzeitchem L'Shalom. We say farewell to the angels. And why is that? Why don't we let them stick around? And the answer is because Friday night is a moment of intimacy between us and God, and even angels shouldn't be present when it's a moment of intimacy. So we send them on their way. And one more thing, we're in text number 7, which comes from the Midrash, where we're told that when you do a mitzvah, Nanette, how about read that one for us, please?
Guardian angels. A person who does one mitzvah is given one angel. One who does 2 mitzvot is given 2 angels. One who does all the mitzvot is given many angels. As it says, he will assign his angels to you, Psalms 91, verse 11. Who are these angels? They are the ones who guard the person against harmful demonic forces.
Thank you. So someone who does mitzvahs receives a guardian angel. And were you ever heading out on a trip where maybe someone said, hey, let me give you a dollar or whatever amount for you to give to charity at your destination? Ever happened to you?
JLI.
It did happen. Oh, JLI to Israel. So in advance, they sent every person in a package. They added a dollar bill. Why did they do that? They did that because, and this is true whenever, if I go visit my mother, before I walk out, she's going to give me some change or a dollar or whatever. The purpose is that they are making you a messenger for a mitzvah, meaning even if your trip was just going on vacation or coming back from vacation, which is definitely productive and nice, but maybe not an actual mitzvah, but you want to turn your trip into a mitzvah. When you do that, you then have the protection of angels. So that's why somebody may give you a dollar to give it to tzedakah, to charity at your destination, and in so doing are trying to protect you with the help of angels as well. The Rebbe did that. Not only if somebody was traveling. I mean, as we know, from April 1986, every single Sunday up until March of 1992, when he had suffered a stroke on a Monday evening, even the day before, on that Sunday, he stood for 6 or 7 hours meeting people and leaving each one of them, man, woman, child, with a dollar bill for a blessing and success. So yes, you're absolutely right. I guess one of the purposes was certainly to, well, I'm not guessing, he said so. The purpose was to make each one a messenger for a mitzvah. It doesn't mean everyone was traveling. Some people may have been local. But regardless, they were becoming a messenger for a mitzvah in the process. So on page 122, there are a number of examples here where we have angels that are playing a role within biblical stories. We're not going to be reading all of them, and you're certainly encouraged to do so on your own time. But just to look at one or two of them, and we may have even mentioned a couple of them already. The first one is angels in the Bible. The first one we have is Hagar and the angels, and we actually mentioned the story in this course already, where Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham to have a child, and we mentioned it in the context of the evil eye. But eventually, she and Ishmael, her son, when he was becoming a negative influence to Isaac, were sent from the home, and she encountered an angel there, actually, who told her and comforted her and told her to reassured her that Ishmael will also become a father to a great nation. We talked about, it was already mentioned, that Abraham had guests at his house, three angels disguised as humans. One came to heal him after his bris at the age of 99. Another one came to bring Sarah the good news that she would be having a child, Isaac, at the age of 90. And the third was there to continue on to Sodom and Gomorrah. The third one had a mission to accomplish there. And a few other is Jacob wrestling the guardian angel of Esau, which is well known, and many others, including Bilam's donkey. Anyone remember that story? Where the prophet Bilam, the Gentile prophet Bilam, was going to curse the Jews, even though he was told not to, but he insisted on going, and on the way, his donkey couldn't advance, got stuck, because an angel was in the way, was obstructing the path. Now, Bilam didn't see the angel, but the donkey actually was aware of the angel. You could see what's going on here, and what Bilam was all about, if his donkey was more spiritual than he. So anyway, there's that scenario and others, and we'll leave it at that for right now. So any quick questions about angels before we advance? Okay, Carlos first, and then Marion.
So when Jacob wrestled with the angel, I mean, of course, he couldn't physically wrestle with an angel. Really don't have form, or maybe like a physical matter thing. So is it possible that maybe it was something within him, like the evil inclination that he was trying to beat, or something like that?
Well, I would agree with you. And by the way, in some contexts, and actually this is crossing over from angels into demons, mm-hmm. The evil inclination is referred to as a demon sometimes. But I would agree with you, if not for the fact that Jacob was physically injured through this encounter. So it must have been with an angel that was manifested within the physical reality. Marion?
No, I just got my question.
Okay, okay, great.
Talking about the angels doing the bedtime Shema, that we're protected and they're always sending us messengers.
Okay, okay. Stanley, something?
You know, I just want to read in the second paragraph. Jacob wrestles an angel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's concerning the form of angels. First, it was angels are ethereal, angels have no form. And then, you know, it was brought out that they can be manifested in a form of a human. So I just want to read that. So far, that's the best example that I've seen. At one point at night, Jacob found himself alone, and Esau's guardian angel appeared in the physical form.
There you go. It says it very clearly. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. So there you go. So that's let's advance and go from angels into the realm of the demons. So we will start with, I think you had a reading already, Nanette. So Bernadine, and by the way, if anyone doesn't want to read, just you'll pass the microphone to the next person, no problem at all. Text number 8, it's a short line out of the Mishnah of Tractate Avot. Please.
10 things were created during the twilight of Friday, the final day of creation. Some say that destructive demonic forces were also created at this time.
Thank you. So, there's a list of 10 things that were created at twilight, meaning there were 6 days of creation, as we know, and then there was Shabbat, where God rested, and we observe Shabbat until today. But the Mishnah here lists 10 things that were created during the twilight of Friday, meaning the last items that were created. And some say that the destructive demonic forces were also created at this time. The point here is not about when they were created. That's a separate conversation. The debate here is only about timing. But nobody's questioning the fact that they were created and that they do exist. It's just that some say that that is when they were created. But that they were created seems to be undisputed. So what are these things exactly? We know they were created. What are they? Lou, if you could please read text number 9 for us. And this is from Nachmanides, otherwise known as Ramban, with an N at the end. Please.
Demon composition. Demons are called Shedim because they reside in desolate areas, Shadu, like the deserts. They are primarily found in the extremities, such as in the northern part of the world that is desolate because of the cold. Demons are formed from a combination of the elements of fire and water, and fire and air, and their form can't be sensed or grasped by any of our senses. The angels' form is intangible, and because they are so light, they can fly with the fire and wind.
Thank you. It was a mistake, it's supposed to say demons right there in the second to the last line, the demons form. But the point is, what we have here is we don't have absolute clarity what they are, we just have some information here. So Nachmanides is telling us that demons are semi-physical, semi-spiritual beings, some description, but still intangible. We can't really grasp exactly what they are. Also telling us where they reside, extremities, abandoned places. So that's number one, what we have from Nachmanides. Not everyone agrees, as we've come to learn in the previous lessons, that there's very, very sometimes extreme different positions, even among the greatest of sages. And Maimonides implies that he doesn't believe in demons. And another commentator, a sage known as Ralbag, also totally disagrees and says that that his position is really that, let's take a look here, demons cannot be grasped with human senses. That's Nachmanides. And we said that demons favor abandoned and desolate terrain. Ralbag says that demons are purely a psychological problem, projections of the mind. So he takes the approach that these aren't entities at all, but these are all things in people's imaginations, and we project certain things, and that is what a demon is, if it is. And we always use these terms when it comes to people. Somebody is struggling with their inner demons. So that would be something that Ralbag agrees with, but not that they are an actual entity looking to make trouble, so to speak. Again, just like we said about the angels, the demons as well don't have any independent power. Even if they have a certain purpose, and if we take the position that they are real entities, and again, the Mishnah does say so, they don't have any independent power, they don't have any control. They can't do anything if they aren't appointed or instructed by God to do whatever it is that they need to do. In other words, there's nothing that we need to, we don't need to get carried away, so to speak, and become obsessed with demons.
Or fear them.
Because it's also worth noting, well, first of all, like I said, they have no, even when they were around, they had no independent control over anybody or anything. But, especially in more recent times, there's less and less to worry about these things. Because, number one, in the Talmud, it already says that these shadim, just to be clear, shade is this term that's in the singular. Demon in Hebrew is shade, a shin dalet. By the way, when we were kids, we didn't even utter the word shade. We would just say shin dalet. We would say the letters with which it's spelled. We wouldn't even actually utter the word. Of course, we're using it now for educational purposes, but sheidim is the plural for demons, and the Talmud says that we already that they shouldn't be bothering people any longer. One a well-known Hasidic Rebbe, known as the Kutzker Rebbe, he said that Maimonides ruled. He didn't say it kind of in a philosophical context. He said it in a legal context that these things. Don't exist. So this Rebbe said that by Maimonides ruling such, he actually affected that on high there should be no such thing anymore. In other words, we have less and less to worry about these things. And finally, the Baal Shem Tov, who was the founder of the Hasidic movement, born about 325 years ago, roughly, and it's been reported about him that he further distanced any demons from human civilization. And we know that he had uniquely had miraculous powers, and this was also said in reference to the Baal Shem Tov. So, what does this have to do with us? What role do angels play in our life? Of course, we identified certain times we mentioned them and this and that, but what role do they play? And if, for that matter, do demons play any role? So, we'll read a text, which is from Jewish mysticism and Hasidic philosophy specifically. Let's first read it, and then we'll analyze it a little bit. Jake, you ready?
Sure. Yeah.
Text number 12, please.
Demonic and angelic feelings. Why are demons called destructive forces? The negative spirits and demons don't have any ability to transgress God's will. Side of holiness and the side of impurity are complete opposites, good and evil. Entities on the same side of holiness have two distinguishing qualities. Firstly, they completely surrender to godliness and do not perceive themselves as independent entities. Secondly, they are inherently good and kind towards others, selflessly giving from all they possess to sustain the poor and to do good to all. The underlying characteristic is putting one's own interests aside to benefit others, and the cause of this is the feeling of complete surrender to God. The side of impurity has the exact opposite nature. It considers itself all-important and only feels its own needs, and it doesn't have any feeling of selflessness, only of arrogance and grandeur.
Thank you. So let's understand what a demon is. So we said that demons don't have any control or independent free choice of their own. They're just doing what God has them do. If that's the case, then what's the problem? Why are we even calling them destructive if they're just doing what they're told? And the answer is that yes, they are doing what they have to do by design, but what we're talking about specifically is not what they do, but their attitude. What is their attitude? What's the attitude of a demon? What is a demonic attitude? And that is the opposite of an angelic attitude. When you call somebody an angel, what does that usually mean? Usually it means someone who doesn't see themselves too much as an independent entity. They don't take themselves too seriously. They take life seriously, but not themselves seriously. What does that mean? That they acknowledge that God is the source of all their blessings and not their own doing. They don't take credit for their own successes. They acknowledge that God is the source of their blessings and of their success. If that's the case, what does that do to a person? When someone realizes that everything they have comes from God, it makes them humble. And if it makes them humble, then any blessings they do have, they look to share with other people, because it's not about them. If it's about me and my successes and things that I achieved, and I attribute my success to myself, so that's going to lead me to selfish attitudes and behaviors. However, when I'm able to acknowledge that what I have comes from God, when I don't see myself as an independent entity, when I see myself just as an extension of God, just like the light of the sun is just doing exactly what it's supposed to do, it's just an extension of the sun giving light and warmth. When we see ourselves that way, we are just an extension of God to bring light and warmth and spread kindness in this world to other people. That is an angel-like attitude. And the way we can become that way, like we said, is when we just see ourselves as an extension of God. But when we see ourselves as something independent, and that we achieved what we did with our own doing because we are so smart and we are so strategic and we made the right moves in the right time, and that's why I achieved what I achieved, that is going to lead me to a more selfish attitude and selfish behaviors too, because it's all about me. So here we have the difference in between the demon and the angel. So demons have no independent power. We should not engage with them. So this is an angel mindset, humility, recognizing and appreciating that we were created by God and are fully dependent on Him. And the demon mindset, on the other hand, is one of selfishness, seeing oneself as solely responsible for all achievements and success. And what each one of these produce, we just spelled out. One produces a person who is more selfless, versus the demonic attitude produces someone who is more selfish. Just to close off on this topic, when it comes to angels, we have to understand this, that as great as angels are, yes, they're more spiritually aware than we are, but they're not nearly as valuable as we are. In fact, angels are envious of human beings because angels don't have the ability to perform a mitzvah here in this world. They have a very specific thing that they're created for, their program. They could do what God gave them to do, and that's it. They can't make a difference on their own. In other words, yes, if you want to rank spiritual sensitivity, who's going to win, an angel or a human? Which one is more spiritually sensitive? An angel. But if you want to rank personal authenticity, let's just say, which one is going to win, the human or the angel? The human. The human has the ability to achieve what an angel can't. Because when a human being acts like an angel, they actually made a choice to do so. They're not programmed to do so. They are choosing to do so, which is much more valuable. I don't know who the story happened to, but somebody came, was a student, was speaking to the Rebbe, and was talking about trying to decide on a direction in life and talking about what a person accomplishes, so that somehow the conversation got to the difference in between angels versus a human being. And the Rebbe illustrated it to him as follows. He said, if you have a picture of a certain scene versus a painting of that same scene, which one is more perfect? The picture that somebody took with their camera or the painting? The picture is more perfect because you capture exactly what there is. That's what the picture picks up. But which one is going to cost more than the other? The painting is going to cost a lot more. Why? It's imperfect. It may be imperfect, but it was done and produced with human effort. That's the difference between an angel and a human being. The angel is a picture. Is it more perfect? Absolutely. Created by God, all spiritual, they do exactly what they're designed to do. But where's the value? The value is radically more in the painting, with its imperfections. because somebody actually put their heart and soul into it. And that's what a human being has the capacity to do when we go about our day-to-day life. Any quick questions before we proceed? Yes, Ron. Well, Amalek was a human being.
Right,
maybe they acted, they certainly acted demonic, but I don't know of them being associated with demons per se. I mean, I'm sure they're inspired and motivated by demons, but they were enemies of the Jews. The earliest reference within the Bible to demons, within the actual verses, well, yes. So the source that we quoted is from the Mishnah. So, in all likelihood, that is the earliest source. Now, within the Midrash, which is the oral tradition, there could be references there to demons about events that happened in biblical times. For example, I'm not even sure I get it myself, and not to get into it, but there's this concept of Lilith, right? Whatever, Eve, before Eve, we're not going to get into it right now, but that is one of the names for a demon. So it seems like they certainly were around from the very beginning, even though it's not referenced within the Torah itself. Yes, Colin?
Why would God create demons?
Someone has to do the dirty work. Who's going to do it? Again, they're designed with a very specific role. God, certain things are good things that need to be achieved. There's angels like Michael, Michael, Gabriel. Each one has their role. But then there's also an angel of death. We should never know of it. But what does it mean? It means it's God's angel for this purpose. And God needs that to be achieved too. Hopefully no one less than 120 years, but someone needs to fulfill that role as well. Yes.
So what about like bad influences, like in the Garden of Eden, the snake? Is that a demonic reference
The Talmud does say that the snake is just another term for Satan, for the evil inclination. It's all the same concept. You could say it's a destructive force. Certainly, some will identify it as the same thing. Some identify the demon or demons as the evil inclination, which every one of us have. We all have a positive, godly soul, and we also have an animal soul, good inclination and evil inclination. So, yes, to some opinions, we have to understand there isn't, as we noted tonight, the opinions are very, very broad when it comes to these things, so there's certainly some that do identify it as such. One second, Carlos?
So about the dirty work or hard labor, didn't King Solomon put the Asmodeus, the king of demons, supposedly to do the hard labor to build the temple? That's some of the stories that I've read, at least.
To build the temple?
To help build the temple. Yeah.
It could be. But, I mean, these things are... if we have time, we may mention it, but it's certainly there. I mean, there's a story... Anyway, we'll come to it. It's a little bit of a different context. But... Yes, I mean, it's been around. But what I said before is that the oral tradition sheds light on it, but it doesn't actually appear within the text of the Bible. Stuart.
So you could almost argue that the snake was doing God's will and testing Eve, but, you know, when you talk about Lilith and Satan, they seem to have independent thought process.
That's why I didn't mention it, I referenced it, yeah. but it's problematic in Jewish belief. To say that anything has any independent control other than from God. So as far as the snake, absolutely. It was all part of the plan. It wasn't a mistake. Okay. Who's ready for ghosts and spirits? All right, so another paranormal life form is spirits and ghosts. Anyone have a definition for a ghost? What do you think of? What does it mean?
Yeah, I've seen ghosts.
You've actually seen them?
I've seen, yeah. And
really?
Yeah. In the hospital, when I was in the hospital a couple of times, I saw them in the room, you know. But thank God they were had clothing on and... You know,
well, if you're here, then you must have gotten rid of them, so that's a good sign.
And then at the house, there was a large ghost that was looking down at me, and I closed my eyes, and when I opened them, he was still there. So I guess...
In a disguise of a human?
Yes.
Was he friendly?
They
doesn't seem like it.
At all, you know, they just were
she,
there.
She didn't wake me up to tell me about it.
So it wasn't that bad. Okay, so let's explore a little bit of what these spirits are and how they appear, if in human form, etc. So the first thing we have to understand once again is that when we talk about spirits and ghosts, we're talking about souls. So we have to understand first and foremost what a soul is. Before we talk about a disembodied soul, what is a soul? So as far as a soul is concerned, let's go to text 14. Would you like to read for us, Jeannie? Text 14 on page 132, it's a line out of Genesis. God formed
the human of soil from the earth and breathed into his nostrils a neshama, soul of life, and the human being became a living being.
Okay, thank you. So, how long do you think I can talk for? I'm not saying how long you want to sit here listening to me, but if I would just talk and talk and talk, I can go on for hours, right? Possibly. But if somebody is blowing, how long can they do that for? Maybe a few seconds? Why is that? Because when we talk, yes, there is some breath emerging from us, but it's a small measure. When somebody blows, then their whole innards are coming out in the process. So how did God create or place a soul into the first human being? Unlike everything else that he created by speaking with his utterances, and God said, let there be light, etc., when it came to the soul of man, the verse states clearly that he blew it into Adam, which means that it came from a very deep place within God Almighty. That is the origin of the soul. If that's the case, so number one, we know it's from God, but we also know it comes from a very deep place within God. So the soul of a human being is a piece of God. It's a piece of the divine. It is a divine spark. Now, if we want to understand this a little bit, so the point is that the soul and the body are two different entities. The body existed first, and then the soul was blown into it. And now you have a body that is alive. Think of, I know we don't wear them here too often, but back in Detroit we did. We had gloves that we put on in the winter, right? Maybe some people have them here. When you wear a glove, then if you move your fingers, the glove moves, right? When you take off the glove and put the glove on the table, is it going to move? No, because your hand is now removed from it. The only thing it had going for itself was that your hand was in it. Once it's removed from it, it's not going to have any movement at all. And similarly, when it comes to the body of a human being, as long as the soul is in it, then it's going to have life, it's going to function, it's going to move, etc. Once the soul is removed from it, then all it is a body, and that's it, like it was before the soul came into it. So what happens to the soul after it leaves after death, after it leaves the body that it inhabited. So there's a number of possibilities or phases. If you don't mind joining me on page 134, I'm not going to dwell heavily on each one of these. I encourage you to read up on them. Maybe you did before or after the class, but just briefly. So the first thing we talk about, the first station of the soul, we call Gan Eden. Gan Eden is translated as paradise. So a soul of a righteous person, somebody lived a perfectly righteous life, when their time comes, their soul departs from the body and it goes directly to paradise, directly to Gan Eden. That is a perfectly saintly individual. The vast majority of people don't go directly to paradise, but there's first a different stop before that. And that stop is, some people call it hell, some people call it purgatory. The only reason why I wouldn't call it hell is because we have a very different understanding of what it is from the way it's understood in other religions. In other religions, they see it as a destination. Judaism absolutely does not see it as a destination. It's just a phase. Where does the word purgatory come from?
Purge.
Purge, right? So what happens? Why does the soul need to be purged? So think of, I don't smoke at all. Not cigarettes, not cigars, but I once or twice went with a friend to a cigar lounge, because I wanted to meet with him and another person, and that's where they, if you want to meet them, that's where they are. Okay, so I went for it. But after leaving, whatever it was, an hour or 2 hours of being there, so it came home with me. I had to leave those clothing outside until they can go directly to the washing machine. So the thing is that when a soul lives its life here in this world within a body, even if it lives a fairly righteous life, nonetheless, just the fact that it engaged in worldly affairs for that long, so it picks up what we'll call schmutz. It picks up some smoke or some other things, and it needs to be cleaned. It needs to be purged from what it picks up in this world before it could enter into paradise. In other words, what is paradise? Paradise means that the soul is going to enjoy and bask in the divine light and glory. But when a soul just comes from this world, it's not able to appreciate the beauty of the divine. Before it enters into paradise, it needs to go through this phase of a cleansing phase. Just think of a washing machine. And once it goes through that, then it's ready to be able to resonate and appreciate and be sensitized to godliness and be able to enter paradise. So, just by the way, you should know, the Talmud says the longest that somebody could spend in purgatory, the longest is 12 months. Sigh of relief. By the way, you may or may not know, that when we say Kaddish after losing a loved one, we say Kaddish for 11 months. So Kaddish, of course, helps this process and helps the transition. But we only say it for 11 months and not 12 because we want to assume that our loved ones are certainly not of those that needed the full 12 months of purgatory before being ready to enter paradise. So across the board, according to Jewish law, we all say it for only 11 months. So that's as far as those two possibilities. And then you come to a concept of reincarnation. By raise of hand, do you think Judaism believes in reincarnation? Okay, a few of you. What's that?
But not like Hindus do.
I'll take your word for it. I'm not sure what they believe. But what Judaism believes is, well, it could be they believe actually. Again, I'm sure there's a lot to it, but it may generally be that in their understanding, the entire soul of a human being leaves, when its time comes for it to leave this body and it returns to heaven, that same soul in its entirety is then enclosed and starts a life in a different body. In the Jewish belief, it's not so simple. In other words, when our soul comes into this world, we have a certain amount of time to achieve our mission in life. But it's possible if we waste some time, then when we lose out a day, when we waste a day, we didn't just waste a day. We lost a piece of our mission because there may be something that I needed to accomplish, which I needed today to do. But if today just passed me by and I wasn't productive, I now lost the opportunity because tomorrow I have other things, other parts of my mission that need to get done. So what happens if certain things are undone? But my soul had its mission designed and cut out for it before it came into this world. But if I only finished 90% of my mission or 98% of my mission, then there's a certain part of it that is still unfinished. So what happens? A part of one's soul. A soul is a flame. So just like you can take one flame and you can light an endless amount of candles from that one flame, that's how we should think of a soul. A soul is a flame. The candle of God is the soul of man. Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam. What happens? So when the soul comes back to heaven, so the aspects of the soul which completed their mission, let's just say most of the soul will stay in heaven. But the sparks of the soul which are associated with those aspects of my mission that were unfinished, those components or those sparks of my soul may come into a new life, and they may be an entire soul of the next lifetime of my soul. Even though in the previous lifetime it was very different. It had a different makeup, let's just say. Now only some of it will go back into a body and start a new life. Am I making sense here? Okay. So that's the concept of reincarnation. Again, I just wanted to touch upon it briefly. Anyone ever hear of the concept of a dibbuk? A dibbuk means, what the word actually means, by the way, anyone know how you say like glue in Hebrew? Devek. Devek, same word, which means to attach or to connect. So it's possible there are certain souls which they come up, when the time comes, they'll come to heaven, and at heaven they'll say, sorry, you're not ready. They'll come to the gates of purgatory, and over there they're also going to say, I'm sorry, but we can't let you in here. We're talking about very, very unique situations, souls that are totally problematic, that they're not even ready to be purged. I mean, that's a level. So what's going to happen to this soul? A soul like this is like a disembodied soul. It's basically either a soul or a spark of a soul that's just like floating around and doesn't really have anywhere to kind of rest and isn't finding rest. So the concept here is, dibbuk means that this soul will attach itself to another soul. Sometimes somebody is like taken over and possessed. It's possible. There's no way to know for certain. And again, these are very uncommon, extremely uncommon. There's certain stories about them in Jewish history. It's a thing. But again, it's not a common thing. And a part of somebody's soul will kind of come into another person seeking to be rectified or to kind of be remedied by whatever that soul, the host soul, is going to be doing. It may help the soul that is attaching itself to it. Anyway, so there is this concept, and again, uncommon, but very rare too. I do want to say just one thing, one episode that's shared in Jewish literature close to 2,000 years ago already, and this is very, it's worthwhile to know this, and that is that Rabbi Akiva, the great sage, was once, I believe he was walking, he was in a cemetery, and this thing, an entity, approached him. You can call it a demon, you can call it whatever you want, and he kind of asked, like, what's going on? And this thing said to him that I represent the soul which already left this world, but I have one son, but my son never studied. He never studied Torah. He never even learned to read Hebrew. And he's not reciting Kaddish for me. I need someone to go to the city where he lives and to teach him how to read so that he can recite Kaddish for me, because I can't find any rest in the next world. This is recorded in Jewish literature. Rabbi Akiva did this favor for this entity that approached him. He went to that town. He taught this fellow to read Hebrew so that he could begin saying Kaddish. And some time later, he was again visited by the same being that thanked him for doing what he did, because only after Kaddish was recited by his son was he able to find rest in the next world. And this is, of course, why reciting Kaddish for a loved one has become so critical and so essential. And, of course, that's how it should be. And there are people who maybe haven't been to synagogue in decades, but after losing a loved one, they make it a top priority to do so and to learn how to say it. I'm saying these things happen on a regular basis. In the last month, it happened right here. Someone who has not been a regular in shul, to put it mildly, but when the time comes, they give it the attention it deserves, because this is extremely critical and plays a very, very significant role for the soul of our loved ones. So there is still a lot more I want to achieve in the next few minutes. I'm going to be a little brief with some things, and you're free to read them afterwards. I'll just take this last question now. All of the questions will be after. Stanley.
So, the wandering soul, I like to read this out loud, the second paragraph. You cure the possessed person when you take hold of their arm, feel their pulse. While holding the arm or recite a specific verse in various forms, and meditate on the divine names, the different arrangements of the letters form. Okay, so that translates into something like an exorcism. So, and then we've had other terms that in Buddhism, Christianity, Catholicism, we have exorcism.
So that's like what a dibbuk is. And basically, if someone feels like they're possessed by a dibbuk, they will look for help. So this Kabbalist, Rabbi Chaim Vital, who was the number one student of the Ari, who's buried in Tzfat in northern Israel, the great Kabbalist, so he is writing here, and we didn't read it, but he's writing this, that he did this for people to help them, to help free them from this dibbuk.
So my point is that this, you know, Christianity, Catholicism, reincarnation, of course, Buddhism, I just like to make that more really specific, but these apparently are originally Jewish concepts.
Everything good they have comes from us. General rule. Everything good they have comes from us. The rest doesn't. What's that?
I say, aren't we admonished not to be grandiose?
Just among brothers here, don't worry. I mean, you pulled it out of me, I have to say. But anyway, so just very briefly, there's a concept called a seance, or a medium, where somebody that wants to communicate with a soul that left this world, it's something that's real, that exists till today. There are people who I know who have gone to mediums to try to get some communication from a lost loved one. The Torah, straight in the Bible, in Leviticus, in 17:8, tells us do not turn to the practice of Ov. And we're not going to read the whole 17b. Like I said, there's a lot still I want to do. And 17b just tells us what it is, but the Torah warns us outright that we should not pursue this type of information. Doesn't say that it's not real. It says that we should not pursue it, because it's coming from an impure source, and that's not a Torah or Jewish way of how to communicate with the souls of the departed. So it's not that way. And by the way, and again, we're a little pressed for time, but King Saul actually went to a medium, even though he absolutely knew that it was the wrong thing to do, but it was after Samuel the prophet passed away, and he used to get all his communications from Samuel, if to go to war or what to do, and etc. All the huge decisions that he had to make all came with the help of Samuel. After Samuel's passing, he tried to get instructions when it came to a war with the Philistines, and he was not getting any answers. So he went disguised, he went to a medium and asked the medium to invoke the soul of Samuel, which she did, and it's recorded in the Bible, in the book of Samuel, and Samuel actually came to the king and said, "Why are you bothering me? Why are you interfering with my journey?" And he told him the issue, but he said that you're God already told you what's happening, and that your kingdom is going to be passed on to King David. Anyway, the point is that he did something that he was not supposed to, clearly. What is the right way to do so? And is there a way to do so? So how do we communicate with souls of the departed, and especially loved ones? And this is something that people turn to me about, and anyone who experienced a loss, who lost a loved one of someone close to them, thinks, of course, it's something we think about every day. But what is the right way to go about it? And is there a way? So the answer is, in brief, that the soul has five components. And namely, these five components are nefesh. I'm going to name them all quickly. Nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, and yechida. I started from the lowest to the highest. We're only going to talk about the first two of five right now. And those are nefesh and ruach. Nefesh is the level of the soul that actually gives life and vitality to the body, enables the physical, biological life. That's nefesh. Then you have the level of ruach, which enables human emotions. Ruach represents the person's emotions. So when the soul departs from this person at 120, when their mission is completed here on earth, four out of five of these levels depart from the soul. The lowest level, called nefesh, actually remains close to the body. Excuse me, I said departs from the soul. I meant departs from the body. Four out of five depart from the body. The first level, the lowest level of nefesh, actually remains close to the body and remains and hovers with the body at the grave site. And this is why we actually visit grave sites in Judaism and in Jewish belief. And by the way, it's not the time to go into a lengthy discussion, but this is just another very important and critical reminder how Judaism believes exclusively in burial and not, God forbid, in cremation, which unfortunately is becoming more and more popular among Jews. The vast majority of them just don't know. They're just not aware of what Judaism believes about this. And anything we're saying here now is only applies to when someone is actually buried in the Jewish way, according to Jewish tradition of 4,000 years from Abraham and maybe and Sarah, maybe even earlier. Well, certainly earlier. So I'm not going to get into it further now. If you do want to discuss it, first of all, I encourage you to read up on it. There's a lot online about it. If you want to approach me afterwards or another time, feel free to do so. If you know friends who are considering it, again, they just don't know. And we have a responsibility to educate people so people have an understanding of something extremely critical and fundamental to Jewish belief. But when it comes to visiting the gravesite of someone who did depart, so we don't go to that site because that's where the body is. Because like we said, the body is just like a glove. It was home for the soul, but it isn't anymore. Unless, like we're saying now, that there actually is one dimension of the soul that remains there. And that's why we still go there. We go there because of the soul, not because of the body. The body is just a body. What we love about a person when they're alive is their soul. The essence of a person is their soul. And that's what we're going to even after their passing. And in fact, there was certain communities that were once going to leave a certain neighborhood and move. The whole community was going to move elsewhere, and somebody in that community had a dream that, and somebody who is buried in that cemetery came to them and really encouraged them not to leave this neighborhood, because we get tremendous pleasure when you actually visit us in the cemetery. And even though we don't necessarily appreciate it on a level of the reality that we live in. But nonetheless, we need to know that the soul is aware when we do visit their gravesite. They're aware of it, and they appreciate it, and they know what's going on in our life. They feel our pain. They celebrate with us in our joy. and they take pleasure in it, and we bring tremendous benefit to the soul when we do visit their when we visit the gravesite of a loved one. So it's really important to know this, and we will read text 21. Hedy, please. Page 145, text 21.
Care packages. When children say Kaddish for their father or mother, it is like sending regards. When they learn a chapter of Mishnah on their behalf, it is like sending them a letter. And when they fulfill mitzvot and good deeds for the benefit of the soul, it is like sending them an entire package.
Thank you. This is from Rabbi Aaron of Karlin, lived a few hundred years ago, and it's a very powerful text because it really teaches us that the relationship that we had does not come to an end. Death doesn't end the relationship. We have the ability to continue it. We have the ability to bring pleasure to their soul, even afterwards, in these various ways that we were just told. So we're going to do two things now, and forgive me for going a little bit over time, but I want to close, number one, with a video about extraterrestrials and Jewish sources when it comes to that, and then we'll have another short video afterwards for the closing. So let's go to this one first.
Humans are curious. Gazing into dark skies to inspect its shiny objects has been a fact of life for as long as human life existed. But what about those planets and galaxies? Does any life exist there? Is there anything out there on any planet, anywhere, staring in our direction and dreaming? Jews love questions, and this one was presented on several occasions to Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, known simply as the Rebbe, whose knowledge of both Torah and scientific sources was truly remarkable. The Rebbe insisted that Judaism does not rule out the chance that life may exist elsewhere, and that classic Jewish sources are divided as to whether such life actually exists. But when it comes to the purpose for which God created the cosmos, planet Earth is unique. Only its human inhabitants received a Torah from God, and only they have the capacity for free choice. So, is there life on Mars? Perhaps, but there are certainly no synagogues. In the early 1960s, a leading Jewish scientist, Professor Velvel Green, worked for NASA's Planetary Quarantine Division. He asked for the Rebbe's opinion on his exobiology program that was seeking signs of life on other planets.
I said, you know, there are those, and I use the word, there are those of your followers who say that the Jews should not be working in the space biology program, the exobiology program, because it goes contrary to Torah. The Rebbe stopped one of those beautiful moments in time. He didn't smile. And he just thought. And then he came back with this and he said as follows, exactly the way I'm doing it. He pointed at me. And he was saying this in Yiddish. You should look for life on Mars. I should keep looking for life on Mars. And if you don't find it, keep looking elsewhere, and elsewhere, and keep looking. Because to sit here in this world and you say there is no life elsewhere is to put a limit around what God can do. And that nobody can do. Now the Rebbe didn't say there was life on Mars. The Rebbe just said that the job of a scientist who is trained in that profession is to keep looking for it.
But not everyone received such a response from the Rebbe. In 1978, a similar question was posed by a young Jewish man living in Milan, Italy. He and his friends had been debating the question of extraterrestrial life, and they turned to the Rebbe to inquire about the Torah's perspective. The Rebbe wrote back, but his reply was as distant from his response to Professor Green as the Earth is from Mars. He advised the questioner that although nothing in Judaism negates the possibility of extraterrestrial life, it was not advisable for him to be spending time investigating the question. Instead, he should focus on the terrestrial life surrounding him. I must admit, that I answered your question without great enthusiasm. This is like a scenario in which we face a dangerously ill patient or a burning house. And instead of trying to save the patient or extinguish the fire, we deliberate profound theoretical questions about the cosmos. Such inquiries won't do a thing to help the patient or extinguish the fire. Similarly, today's Jewish youth are seeking direction. They are missing the path of Torah and its commandments, which is the path of true life. And this crisis is not happening somewhere in the heavens, amid the planets, nor in a remote corner of the earth, but rather in the immediate vicinity of you and your friends in Milan. And it is a matter of vital importance. God promises us that when we truly exert ourselves in this regard, we will succeed. Two different individuals, two very different responses. So, is there extraterrestrial life? Well, it seems that if you're a professional scientist with your head in space, advance science, discover more of God's wonders. But if you belong to the rest of humanity, seek life on Earth, work tirelessly to enhance it, and create wonders here for others.
Okay, wonderful. So, in closing, we, of course, enjoyed four great classes together. We talked about dreams in the first. We talked about the stars. We talked about curses and the evil eye, blessings. And, of course, tonight, the vision of angels, demons, etc. But you said the critical point to close out with is that, yes, and we discussed each one at length, how much Judaism attributes, how much value we attribute to each one of these things. But the ultimate takeaway needs to be that God is the ultimate power and the only power. And that's where we should put our faith, that's where we should put our trust. And in the closing concept that we discussed tonight, which was ultimately that each one of us have a soul, and our soul has a very specific mission and an individual mission here on earth. And this is true about our own, about our loved ones. And on that note, if I may, just for a couple more minutes, I want to close out with a beautiful song that really brings home this idea. Just want to let you know in advance, and we said the word angel in Yiddish, or in Hebrew, is malach. Malachol is like a nickname for an angel. And soul in Hebrew is neshama, and neshamaleh is another way of referring to the soul. And please enjoy, and with this we will close this incredible course.
Thank you.
destiny.